from St. Louis Public Radio. This is St. Louis on the Air.
So and the defense did not bring up that this was false evidence. You were left with the impression this was good science.
Until just recently.
What was that like to finally talk about everything that happened so many years ago?
It was heavy. It was relief.
Yeah.
And I think of anything, forgiveness for Michael.
You feel like you want his forgiveness.
Absolutely. I was asked recently, did you buckle in court? I don't think I buckled. I think I was lied to, and I think the justice system failed us. From this point forward, the gentleman needs to be released from prison, and if nothing more, an apology for what's been done to him.
I'm Sarah Fenske. Michael Polite has been in custody since he was 14 years old. He has spent 2 decades in prison for the murder of his mother, Rita. Rita Polite was beaten to death in her home in Washington County, Missouri, and then set on fire. That was in December of 1998. Mike was the youngest of her 3 kids, the only one still living at home. He and his friend had a sleepover that night at Rita's trailer. They told sheriff's deputies they woke up to the smell of smoke and discovered that scene of horror. But as Mike and I discussed last month, Mike quickly became a suspect.
It's their opinion that I acted strange or acted funny. Sheriff Ron Skiles, he said that I didn't act the way that he acted when his mom passed. I'm sorry that he lost his mom because I know what that's like. But I would like to know the circumstances of which he lost his mom.
So they ended up arresting you and pretty quickly.
They arrested me December 7th, 1998.
So this is basically 48 hours later.
Mm-hmm.
You begged the officers to take your fingerprints.
I did.
Because you said somebody was trying to frame you for something you didn't do.
I did.
You felt like if they could just look at your fingerprints and compare that to what was there, that you'd be exonerated.
I offered everything. I cooperated with them to the point where they just didn't want my cooperation anymore. As a matter of fact, when they wanted to re-exhume my mother, because they had failed or forgot to take her fingernails, my attorney at the time, Wayne Williams, looked at me at this court proceeding and said, Bernie, we can object to this. I said, don't. Because I'm trying to give them evidence to exonerate me.
And so what would be under her fingernails might be DNA from the person who killed her.
Exactly.
You're looking at this like a chance to get to the bottom of this.
Yes. Justice for Rita.
That is Mike Polite. He has insisted all along that he did not kill his mother. And 12 years ago, he finally got someone to listen. The Midwest Innocence Project got his letter and came to visit him in prison to hear more. He told me how he felt after finally getting to explain to someone how he'd been railroaded.
I left that visit, and I paced myself for 4 days. I wore a hole in the floor, right? And I'm reliving everything that I told him. And I'm reliving the expressions that I'm seeing as I'm telling my story. And they were just disgusted. They were just in awe, and they were just, you could see in the faces of how did this happen? And from that moment on, I knew that I had help, and I knew that they were gonna get me out of here.
In August, the Midwest Innocence Project, along with the Roderick and Solange MacArthur Justice Center, filed Mike's petition for relief in appellate court. They were swiftly denied. But yesterday, they took their plea to the court they always thought was their best shot, the Missouri Supreme Court. And this time, they had something new, an affidavit from a juror. Linda Dickerson Bell was on the jury that sent Michael Polite to life in prison with no chance of parole. And she joins us today to share what happened and how she feels about it today. So, Linda. No, welcome.
Good afternoon.
So Michael Polite was on trial as a 17-year-old in Washington County, Missouri. You were chosen for the jury.
I was.
Take us back. Were you eager to be put on this jury?
I was somewhat arrogant that I wouldn't be put on the juror, to be quite frank with you.
And why did you think that?
My father was the current foreman of the grand jury for St. Francis County. My father was a police officer I served on the Park Hills City Council and worked very closely with law enforcement, and it was my assumption, and we know what those are, but it was my assumption that I would not be chosen because they did not want someone closely related to law enforcement.
That seems like a pretty solid assumption, but in this case, it wasn't right. They let you on that jury.
I thought I'd be in and out. I didn't make reservations for anything other than the afternoon, and you're right. I mean, it took me aback.
And so you ended up getting on this jury. What was it like hearing the case? They're trying to convince you that this guy is guilty, and the prosecutors put a bid into this case.
They absolutely did. Yes, they put in the time and the effort, and they brought forth the evidence. And unfortunately, until I was just recently chosen again, or not chosen, but brought in to be selected for a juror, which I was not chosen for. But until then, I never heard like the information that we should have heard then. The burden of proof is on the state, not on the defendant.
That's not something you were told on this first jury.
Never was told that. Never. If I was told that, it didn't sink in, but I don't believe we were ever told that. It was never reiterated as it was in this last case. I mean, the lady even stood up and said, "You see this gentleman, just because he's sitting here in the condition that he's sitting, he is not guilty. As a matter of fact, he is innocent until proven guilty." That played into that. Just hearing Michael's voice, what that could have done for us during that trial.
So, yeah, he did not testify.
He did not.
At this trial.
He asked to testify. He was advised not to testify.
And yeah, he said that later to the judge at sentencing. But at the time that you're sitting there as a juror, you didn't know that. Were you thinking, okay, I'm waiting to hear this side of things?
That's absolutely what I was thinking. I just kept thinking, I've heard their part. There's always two sides to every story. And so I was waiting to hear the second part that proved that he had not done it. And there was never anything presented. Never. So I can't tell you that there was evidence or proof or motive or anything that was presented that said he was guilty. But what I can tell you is that there was never anything from the defense.
So, yeah, the entire defense in this case, they spent less than half a day.
I didn't know that until recent because I have purposefully not tried not to listen, hear, watch anything about the trial, not because I don't have guilt about it, because I 200% do, but because I didn't want to confuse what I know with what I heard. And so I was very careful about that.
So you were trying to kind of keep this straight in your head. Did you have the sense that at some point somebody might come to you and revisit this case?
I hoped that they would. I absolutely hoped that they would.
So you were waiting.
I was waiting because I didn't know what was appropriate. Was it appropriate for me to reach out to them? Was it appropriate for them to reach out to me? I didn't really know. And I was just hoping and praying. And I make myself readily available. And so, I mean, you can't say Google my name. You can't say that you can't find me. That's nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, you have a pretty prominent position in St. Francis County. You're the executive director of Habitat for Humanity there. You weren't hiding.
Not hiding. I was also running for presiding commissioner. I'd served 24 years on the Park Hills City Council. I was a treasurer for the Chamber of Commerce. Not hiding, no.
And so you were carrying around, as you said, guilt.
Absolutely guilt. I still carry it to this day. Yes.
So you had this guilt. You were thinking at some point somebody might contact you about this. And
yes.
Nobody did.
Nobody did. In 2016, I reached out to, after the MTV movie that went, I reached out and just didn't ask for them to contact me, but just said, hey, I was a juror on that episode, because I didn't want them just to think that I'm looking for anything. I don't want anything from this other than Michael Poli to be given back his life. And I'm not saying do anything with what he's lost already. We can't do anything about that. But from this point forward, the gentleman needs to be released from prison. And if nothing more, an apology for what's been done to him.
And so you reached out to somebody. This was back in 2016,
2016.
Okay. When this TV show did some episodes on this case. You reached out to people on that TV show?
Or? No response. But again, I didn't ask for a response. I just put out there that I was a juror. So then again, my name should have been familiar and they should have recognized me as a juror had they needed the information. And so I thought I had done my part. I think it was for me more so than anything just to say that I tried. And then when this episode came out in August and I had heard about it, it was coming up again. I did read an article in the local Daily Journal, and then I sent in a message, and I think the verbiage is just, I served as a juror, and what can I do to make this right?
And so then at that point, you ended up meeting with Megan Crane.
I did. She came to my home.
And she is an attorney for Mike Polite. She works for the MacArthur Justice Center.
Yes.
Sat down with her there.
Yes. And shared with her just details that had never been, I'd never had an opportunity to share before.
What was that like to finally talk about everything that happened so many years ago?
It was heavy. It was relief.
Yeah.
And I think of anything, forgiveness for Michael.
You feel like you want his forgiveness.
Absolutely.
Because you feel bad about what you did.
Yes. I was asked recently, did you buckle? In court, I don't think I buckled. I think I was lied to, and I think the justice system failed us.
And so you know that you were a part of this jury. You were surprised to be chosen for this jury. You were chosen for this jury.
Yeah, nothing that you really want to be chosen for. It's not the lottery, let me tell you that.
I mean, yeah, you're looking at somebody's life. Like, do they get to go free? Do they end up incarcerated for the rest of their life?
Yes, and that's why I held out as long as I did, was I thought he at least deserved the possibility of parole, just in case. And again, I was 30 years old. I didn't really know what all of this meant. And I mean, I wasn't your typical normal 30-year-old. Yes, I was serving on a city council. I was responsible for lots of things. But I wasn't prepared for what happened in court those days.
So it's ironic. You came in as somebody with a lot of ties to law enforcement. Your dad was a police chief. You had reason to sort of be pro-police.
Absolutely.
And yet through the course of this trial, you're like, wait a minute.
Something didn't feel right. I mean, I hate to say it, and names are names, but there was one gentleman that just continually stuck out in my mind, and his name was Kurt Davis, and they used him as a lot of information for that trial. And looking at the gentleman just told me, something ain't right. He's not telling the truth. Something's not exactly correct. I often wonder, why is he not still in law enforcement?
So this was a witness for the prosecution, one of the law enforcement people on this case.
Yes.
You found him untrustworthy.
I did. Absolutely did. And he proved that a couple of years ago when he reached out through me, through Messenger.
So we're talking today to Linda Dickerson Bell. She was a juror in St. Francis County, one of 12 people who convicted Michael Polite in the 1998 murder of his mother, Rita. He was 14 years old at the time of the murder. He's been in prison ever since. We need to take a quick break, but we'll be back shortly to continue this conversation with Linda. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Now back to our conversation. My guest today is Linda Dickerson Bell. She was a juror in the murder trial of Michael Polite. He was 14 when his mother, Rita, was killed in Washington County, Missouri, and he was convicted as a 17-year-old. He's now 37, and he's been in prison ever since. Mike's lawyers filed a wrongful conviction claim with the Missouri Supreme Court yesterday, and they had affidavits from three jurors as part of that. The latest, the one that is brand new for this filing, was from Linda Dickerson Bell, who now has some grave concerns about what happened at that trial. And Linda, I want to go back to a couple key points in that trial. The state had one piece of physical evidence tying Mike to what they alleged was setting his mother on fire and putting gasoline.
The nail in the coffin is.
So this was important evidence for you.
It was the only evidence. It was the only evidence that they had, and it was the fact that they represented that his clothing and his shoes had gasoline on them. The clothing, I understand, had since been lost. Mm-hmm. That's pitiful in my estimation. And then the fact that apparently in 1998, there was evidence that proved that there was not gasoline on the tennis shoes. It was actually a chemical that was used to make the tennis shoes. The murder didn't happen until late 1998. In 1990, I mean, somewhere either the prosecution should have known this mm-hmm. or the defense should have known this.
So
and
the defense did
shared.
Not bring up that this was false evidence. You
no.
were left with the impression this was good science.
Until just recently.
And so that would have made a big difference for you had you known what the science actually said about the lack of gasoline on those shoes.
It would have confirmed what I thought all along, which was that Michael Polite did not kill his mother.
So there is another thing here that was a very odd thing in that when Michael Polite was younger, he went by the nickname Bernie. And this is short for Bernard. This was just
a
nickname everyone called him by. So at the trial, people frequently referred to him as Bernie.
Even the prosecution. I mean, even the defense referred to him as Bernie.
Why did that make an impression on you?
Because Bernie, to me, was the indication that he liked to burn things. I mean, it was represented as that in the case. And everything that they represented against him was not only that his mother had been burned, but that he had a habit of burning things on a regular basis. And so I thought, and I know that other jurors did as well, that Bernie was the nickname because he liked to burn things.
So you assumed his nickname was B-U-R-N-Y.
Correct.
Not B-E-R-N-I-E.
Correct.
And now that you know that Bernie was just a nickname, again, short for Bernard, how do you feel about that assumption that you made?
Ashamed. embarrassed and hoping that we can fix this. Really kind of ticked off, and I'll use that word because I can't use the other word on the air, but really kind of ticked off that nobody else had thought about this and that the defense, in fact, did not bring that. I mean, that should have been the first thing that he debated.
The defense never explained or never even mentioned, here's why we're calling him Bernie.
No, and maybe people thought it wasn't significant, but to me it was significant.
And you say other jurors you think came to that same conclusion, that Bernie meant he was a firebug, a little arsonist in training.
Yes, yes. And several times the prosecutor had indicated that.
So tell us a bit about these deliberations. You were the one who was a holdout. You were not convinced of his guilt. You, as you said, there was some of this evidence that kind of made you wonder, but you weren't getting much from the defense. You still were not ready to convict.
I was not ready to convict, but I didn't know what other choice we had. I never heard until most recently the word acquit. I mean, I wasn't even aware that it was an option. It was either he was going to prison for life or he was going to prison with life without parole. Those were the two options.
That's what you
that
thought the choices
aware.
Were.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
And so you're there and you have this doubt. You're not sure if this guy is guilty. How did the other jurors or the people there in deliberations with you, how did they react to these doubts that you had and that you weren't sure?
Some sympathetic, others quite arrogant and retaliation. I mean, I don't know what other word to use it, but I will never forget. There was a gentleman sitting two seats to me to the right, almost across the table because it was a shorter table. And I can remember him slamming his hand down on the desk at me when I said, nothing is telling me that he did this. My heart doesn't tell me. The evidence doesn't tell me. But I was waiting the whole time on the defense. Nothing tells me that he did it. And the gentleman tells me, are you stupid? Obviously he did it. Let's get this done and get out of here. And that from that point forward, it's like everybody just kind of jumped on board and let's get this done and get out of here. I never felt good about it. When they pulled the juror, like they do that at the end of the thing, I didn't know this either, but individually you have to stand up and say whether you're guilty or not guilty. I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure what I would say. And when I finally said it, because I had already agreed to it, I cried. I wept. I cried. I was upset.
So there's another juror who filed an affidavit in this case. He was found by the Innocence Project back in 2017. And he mentions you. He doesn't call you by name, but he talks about a woman who had a young child and that she was struggling with this. And he said that the other jurors were worried that when the jury would be polled in the courtroom that you might change what you said.
Sure.
They knew what stress you were under.
Yes.
And so these other jurors have now come forward and said they've had doubts as well. Looking back on this and looking back on that moment when you stood up and you said guilty.
Hardest thing I ever did in my life.
And how do you feel about that today?
Not happy.
Yeah.
Not proud. There are some things in your life you wish you could go back and redo, and this is one of them. Most of my life I've lived trying to be a good person and do the right thing, and this is one thing I think I extremely failed.
So you came forward, you found his attorneys, you met with them, you agreed to meet with us today and tell your story. And Megan Crane, who is now Michael Polite's lawyer with the MacArthur Justice Center, she said she thinks your affidavit could make a big difference. This is a quote from her. She said, the state's prioritization of finality over fairness, trying to say we should just let this stand, is premised on protecting the jury's verdict. Well, that goes out the window when the jurors themselves believe he is innocent and want their verdict reversed. Each of the tests for our constitutional claim asks if the violation made a difference at the trial, if the result would have been different. These jurors make the answer obvious. Do you hope that by coming forward that you can make an impression that the Missouri Supreme Court will reopen this case and bring in a special master?
That has been my hope all along, and I wish I could have done it sooner. But again, I didn't know what was the right thing to do. But from the day I walked out of that, I was never proud of serving on that juror. I felt like we failed. We failed the justice system. Simply because I think a lot of information was kept from us. Like I said, the whole issue with the chemical on the tennis shoes, there were several other things. The fact that the fingernails, once they were exhumed, were misplaced. The clothing was misplaced. I mean, at least it was a poor prosecution, but it was still better than the defense.
So you've kept this in for like 20 years at this point, 21 years. How does it feel to now have this out there?
I can't say that I'm proud. I'll never be proud of it because, like, just my stepmother asked me last night again. You know, did you crumble? I don't crumble. Very rarely do I crumble, but this is something I'm not proud of. I'm the kind of person when you make me mad, nothing motivates me more than madness. And I'm mad because I feel like we were lied to. I'm mad because I feel like the state knew all along that he wasn't guilty. But I think it was ego and pride. And I think it's still ego and pride whenever you're still trying to reach out to that prosecutor and he won't even give you the time of day. I've made mistakes in my life and I'll own up to them. And I hope to goodness that he can do the same thing.
Well, Linda Dickerson-Bell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And we want to leave you today with some words from Mike Polite. He told us this when we spoke to him in September.
I'm gonna throw punches. I'm gonna keep throwing punches. If the Supreme Court denies me, I'm gonna throw another punch. I'm not gonna stop fighting. And justice for Rita. You know, I wish people would yell it out there. I wish people would picket with signs.
This episode was produced by Emily Woodbury, with audio engineering by Aaron Dorr and production assistance from Jane Mather Glass. It was mixed and edited by Aaron. Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here. If you learned something new from today's episode, consider leaving us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the easiest way to help people discover our show. We appreciate it. Thank you. St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.